Well, good evening. As is customary here, we like to start on time. We know you're busy people with places to go and things to do. Good evening and welcome to the second presentation in this, our 14th series of talks on faraway places with strange sounding names, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Kutz, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services at WKU, I coordinate this series with my absent colleague, Peggy Wright, who's at home recovering from knee surgery, and with help from our research instruction coordinator, Brian Carson. Christopher McConnell and Ryan Dowell designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Shaden Atz. Our speaker tonight was born in Chernowitz in Romania, now part of Ukraine, where he lived with his sister and parents. He began studying the violin at age six in 1936. 3 years later, the Nazis invaded Poland and Romania joined the Axis. While studying at a local congregation, he showed remarkable progress and won a prize, making him eligible to study at the Moscow Conservatory. However, the war interrupted that opportunity and the Nazis invaded his hometown, making life for its Jewish residents a living hell. Those not immediately killed were deported to a concentration camp in Transnistria, Ukraine, where he, at the age of 10, was sharing a tiny room with 50 other people, only 12 of whom would survive the ordeal. His father died of typhoid fever. He, his sister, and his mother were liberated after 3.5 years incarceration, eventually making their way to West Germany and then to New York to join his mother's brother. After graduating from the Manhattan School of Music, he became concertmaster and assistant conductor of the Leonard Bernstein Gala Orchestra, and has since played with many orchestras and been a soloist at Carnegie Hall and Alice Tully Hall. He's toured through Europe, South America, Israel, and Korea, and has been playing at the Radio City Christmas Spectacular Orchestra since 1968. His arrangement of Canon in D Major by Johann Pachelbel for violin and piano is widely performed around the world. His writings have appeared in Yiddish and English, and he frequently gives talks in schools on the topic of prejudice and its consequences. Devils Among Angels, published this year by Jonas Press, is a collection of short stories and poems inspired by memories of his childhood years before, during, and after World War II and the Holocaust. And in it, he uses prose and poetry in both fiction and nonfiction to reflect on good and evil in the past and present. Please give a warm welcome this evening to Samuel Martyr. And here to set the stage is Samuel's very good friend, John Cipolla, who's an associate professor of music and serving as his host in Bowling Green. John?
Thank you, Brian.
Good evening, everybody. My daughter, Gabriella Cipolla, started a program in Greenwood High School called Reach for Tolerance, which is a program to develop awareness of tolerating others' differences and learning to live together. Sam spoke this morning at Greenwood High School, and this is the introduction that Gabriella gave to the student body. To teach tolerance to one individual is to teach it to generations, for ignorance and prejudice are learned traits and can be conquered by knowledge. Sam Martyr's mission is to teach tolerance and open-mindedness to students like us, to widen the birth of acceptance in our school, our communities, and our lives. Sam has survived the Holocaust, the genocide of millions of Jews in Europe during Hitler's regime, and the final solution of creating a totally Aryan and Gentile race by exterminating the Jewish population. Some of what is said this evening will be difficult to hear. Some pictures may be graphic, but know that this is the consequence of intolerance, and that learning to be open-minded of race, religion, and common differences can mean a human life. Through this presentation, I ask you to reflect upon yourselves and open your minds to the reality of his words. Be kind and understanding in the knowledge that we are all different, that the acceptance of those differences can mean the world, and that together we can make a community void of the horrors that come with hatred. Mr. Samuel Martyr.
Thank you, John.
You want to leave that?
I see. Yeah. Can you all hear me? I guess that might be a little better. Mark Twain once said, "It is by the goodness of God that in our country we have those three unspeakable precious things: freedom of speech, freedom of conscience, and the prudence never to practice them." It is for this reason that I actually decided to talk to people, and especially to young people in schools, because we live in a world which keeps repeating history, and I see no improvement. And part of the reason is that people don't speak up. When something is wrong, when there's evil going on anywhere in the world, there's no one to speak. There was no one to speak when I was suffering, so I decided to speak when other people are suffering now. It is all related. We all live in a very, very much related world. We are dependent on each other as human beings. And no matter what culture we live in, what background we come from, we are interrelated. I even sometimes feel, when I look at our cats in the house, we have three cats, and I look at them and I see how much interrelated we are with them. After all, we come from the same power. And as I get older, I see a closeness, a greater closeness between people, and even I feel a greater closeness to animals. Unfortunately, lately, the danger of prejudice has become so great that it actually endangers the whole world as a globe. It is not anymore a danger that presents itself to people in a certain area. We all know that Hitlerism started with prejudice, and we know what it ended with. God forbid if prejudice keeps going on, one bomb can destroy a whole population. I wish there would be more people that would devote their time to talk about these things, because prejudice is almost an acceptable disease. I don't think there is a person in this room that has not experienced one extent or another, some kind of prejudice. We all suffer from it in one way or in another. And the fear of watching these things, this disease growing all over the world, makes me very fearful of the next generations. So my message really is that only goodness and kindness can change it, can change the whole situation, the situation all over the world. In some cases, prejudice goes so far and is so deep entrenched in people's minds and hearts that, frankly, I have no great hope. But we have to keep on trying. And we have to begin with our own lives, with our own souls, with our own brains, to begin to think what kind of person we want to be. How do we relate to others that may help bring peace? We know that when we throw a stone in the water, there are many repercussions happening in the water. And this is also with human feelings. Violence is not something that is executed by bullets only. There are all kinds of violence. There is the violence of hate, there is the violence of prejudice, there is the violence of simply disliking another person because he's dressed in a different way or has a short nose or long nose. These are all forms of violence. Violence comes through words, it comes through feelings, and it is transmitted very fast because we do react to feelings. I don't have much time to talk about my experiences. We will have to be here a few years to listen to them. But I will just tell you a little, just give you a little picture, and you might get a little feeling about my background. My childhood was a very happy one. I was brought up in a Hasidic environment, closed up from the world, but a happy one. My first experience with prejudice was my first day of going to school, walking to school. And as I ventured out into the streets of my hometown, which I loved very much, it was a beautiful city, my first experience were stones thrown at me. And little boys from another school that belonged to a church somewhere got some education which I wish they would not have gotten. They called me Jesus killer and ran after me. One good thing came out of that, I became a very good runner. When the war broke out, hell really started coming very close home, and we began to realize that our lives are not anymore safe. My father did not want to believe stories that came from Germany about people being shot on the streets. And I remember him saying, "This is not possible, this must be communist propaganda. The Germans would never do a thing like that. The Germans would never accept these insane theories of Hitler." And he actually died an optimist. You heard a little bit about my being 3.5 years in a concentration camp. It was a small camp in which food was not given at all. No food was given. So we were just left to die. They didn't have to shoot us because people died right and left. But after the first winter, which was a fierce winter, those that survived managed to got ourselves out into the villages nearby, into the fields, and whatever we could grab, a potato that the peasant may have left, or a corn, we picked up. And this used to happen always in the dark of the night, because we did not want to be caught, obviously. The other tragedy was that if we were not caught, we could have been also reported by civilians. Because in the Ukraine, anti-Semitism is on a quite high level. And yet there were people who helped us, there were peasants who helped us, and if not for them, we would not have been alive today. A father, German friend of my father wanted to save us. We were friends for a long time, and my father refused. The reason, I found out afterwards, there were two reasons. One was because he did not want to put his friend in danger, although our German friend knew that he was not in danger, he had it all covered. But still my father did not want to take a chance with his life. And the other reason why he refused to go with him was that he felt he did not want to be an exception. And he said, if everyone goes, my family and I should not be an exception. Obviously it was a great mistake, because he did not make it. At the end maybe of the talk, I'll read to you a little poem that I wrote in memory of my father. Yeah. How do we do with time?
You're fine.
The conditions, having brought up in a religious home, I was always brought up to know that God loves me. God loves us. Can you imagine the conflict that I had at the age of 10 when I saw my father with glazed eyes, dead near me on the floor? So I was just waiting for God to wake him up. I knew he was a wonderful person, so God would not punish him, such a person. And as I grew up, I began to realize that I should not complain to God, but the people are creating whatever happiness or whatever misery there is in the world. And from that moment on, I learned not to hate and not to prejudge people and not to generalize. I felt perfectly comfortable after the war with German people. I have some very close friends who I consider brothers in spirit, that I feel I could never have. If I had a brother, I could never have a better brother than one, especially one fellow who lives now in Berlin. It's possible also because I was taught not to hate. After the war, we walked out into the streets and there were thousands of German soldiers lying on the floor. And I can tell you that I felt absolutely no bad feelings toward them. I knew that they were criminals who were taught insane ideas, and that they were brothers of some sisters. They had mothers, they may have had daughters, sons, who are waiting for them to come home. And I never hated them. There is a Jewish concept It's a very beautiful concept, that when your enemy is down, don't celebrate. And I felt that way all my life, that compassion is a wonderful thing, and goodness to others is the only solution to the problem of the world. Goodness, kindness, love cannot be taught in books, but it can be practiced. It comes straight from the heart. And I hope that I lived my life that way, all throughout. I may have had several setbacks with some people who I found that I could not communicate at all. I get very upset when I see prejudice, terribly upset. But that is the end of my feelings. In other words, I never get to hate those people that are prejudiced. I only feel very upset. I had once a very interesting encounter with an extremist Islamist on the internet. And it just came by accident because I'm so bad with computers. So I wound up in the wrong place. As I looked at the statement that he made, was there are too many Jews, too bad he killed so few. Hitler was right. Normally I would not have answered it, but I felt very compelled to answer it. So I answered him. I said, "Do you realize?" Well, first of all, I told him, "I'm one of those that survived. I almost didn't make it. And do you know that if Hitler was alive, you would not be alive to write me this email?" Well, there was a little answer coming, "You dirty Zionist," whatever names they like to call Jews at this point, whatever they can. And I answered him again. I did not give up. And I told him, "Do you know what a Zionist means? To be a Zionist only means that you would like Jewish people to have a place of their own so they can run away when somebody bothers them." And then he answers me, said, I have Jewish friends. Jews are not a religion. Jews are a religion. Judaism is a religion. Jews were never a people." So I told him the Jews were a nation before there was an Iraq, before there was a Jordan, before there was a Syria, before there was a Saudi Arabia. And frankly, if it would be up to me, I would like to see every human being live wherever he wants to. But unfortunately, the world is not built that way. And in some of the countries which you love, a Jew is not allowed even to step in. And the Zionist country, which you call a Zionist entity, Arabs live quite well. They study in the universities. The first Arab women that ever had a chance to study began with in Israel. So I would suggest that you think a little bit about it, and instead of reading propaganda, try to read your own brain. The answer I got: "My friend, the best to you and yours." So that was one fight I won.
I think I'm getting towards the end, right? I think that really progress begins from within. There's a wonderful philosopher by the name of Krishnamurti. Don't think that he's a leader of those who bang on the drums 10 times a day and yell Krishna. He's just the opposite. He does not believe in sticking to being attached to different cultures and all that. He feels that the best culture comes from within. And he says that the best way to improve your surroundings is to begin with ourselves. I love that philosopher. I think he's one of the greatest people that lived in this century. I went to listen to him a few times. And every time I came to listen to him, I left with a good heart, because I knew that there's one man who finally sees the truth that only human beings can
others by proving themselves first. I can tell you that in spite of my decision after my father died to be kind and good to other people, I had great struggles. I had great struggles when I came out of concentration camp. I was lost. I was completely lost. I was disoriented. I could not concentrate. Up to this point, I have trouble concentrating on a book. It takes me a long time to read a book because I go through several sentences and then I stop. So I suffer the consequences up to this day. I have to live with it because I know the sources and I cannot change my past. But I do know I can change the present. To whatever extent I can change it, I do. And I hope to keep on talking for as long as I get the strength to talk and keep on reaching people. And I feel that it is the most important thing that I ever did in my life was to begin talking about prejudice. And I did some things that some people considered important, but nothing equaled what I had decided in the last 10 years. It's to talk to people and talk until I may be able, if I'm able to reach one person, I think it is worth me for me. I will read for you a little poem. It's a little long, but it's not too long. It's in memory of my father. You left this world so soon with my child's heart in unbearable pain, eyes overflowing, streaming with tears. Those marked the final days of my childhood years. In that dark period of insanity's reign, the child in me could not comprehend how God, the God of mercy, let father's life so young, good and kind, so quickly and tragically end. And how you, my father, my teacher, of life of compassion and love, could abandon this world without taking me with you to the heavens above. Our souls were so intertwined. Instead, you told me not to grieve. Hours after your tragic passing, your emaciated, lifeless body lay motionless next to me on the ground. I listened to your silent heart, hoping for a breath, a sound. That silence made me wait for my last breath to end the painful wounds. I fell into a sleep, far too deep, my mother said, to ever wake up. But suddenly you appeared. My pain had disappeared. Surrounded by an unearthly light, you appeared, your face agleam with a euphoric beam. Father is alive! Father is alive! I shouted with all my strength in that dream of my dreams. Don't be sad, my son, you said. Let your heart dismiss the bad. Don't spend your strength on sadness, sorrow. A new life for you is in store in the not distant morrow. Your hand touched my quivering lips. Here, reassuringly, you said, taste this. A tiny piece of matzah it is. It will lighten your weight, lessen your fears. Tasting it, my eyes opened. Your luminous presence suddenly disappeared. I looked at, saw your lifeless face through a curtain of streaming tears. Waited, hoping for your eyes to open, but alas, reality confirmed my fears. You came to me in dream only, and returned to eternity. But gradually I discovered my dream was part reality, for you never left me. I was not alone. Your spiritual fountain fills my life. Its treasure is a source of strength, although a steep mountain it is to climb. Difficulties reaching it, I don't mind. Memories of your kindness, strength, and wisdom lift my spirits, are lessons for life to learn from. Forever they will be enshrined in my heart and mind. Many years since then passed by, your legacy keeps my soul alive. The spiritual fountain did not dry. Your image stands in front of me. Your voice constantly accompanies me. It did not die. It vibrates my heartstrings. Its sound is life and as clear as in the dream when you appeared and will accompany me into eternity. Through hours of despondency, sadness, gloom, and fears, my guiding light, you'll always remain until our souls unite again in that forever peaceful world, a world without tears.
You will be shown some photos that I got in Germany after the war. They were taken by, obviously, by Nazi soldiers. There were no reporters at that time. There was no one to report what was happening. And the sad part, the tragic part, is that those pictures were taken by Nazis who wanted to show off to their families what wonderful things they did. It needs no comment.
Just about that picture before had a advertisement. The marshal, that was the head of Germany before Hitler, the marshal and the corporal fight for freedom and equality. That shows you what propaganda can do.
If anyone from this side cannot see, you can come here. I can stand a few minutes.
Go ahead.
Those who don't see.
Just one little comment here. In front of the concentration camp of Auschwitz, it says, in German, one word did not come out. Arbeit macht frei. That means work makes you free. This is how they tricked in people into the camps, and this is how they gassed them afterwards and burned them.
If there's anyone who has any questions, you are very welcome to come forward.
Yeah. What is it? Could you come a little closer, because my ears are a little different than when I was 18.
You said I assume you're a religious person, right?
Religious? It's a very complex question, because religious means a lot to many people.
Well,
They are observant people who are not religious, and they are religious people who are not observant, and the other forms.
Yeah. Well, the reason why I asked is because there are those who believe that religion is one of the biggest problems that are causing all these issues, like the Holocaust and the wars. They believe that religion is the main issue, and that if we didn't have religion, if people, you know, didn't believe in these imaginary beings, that we would be far better off.
Well, if you remember in the Bible, Cain killed Hevel. He had no religion. Religion doesn't kill, people do. That's my feeling. It's the wrong interpretation of religion. People like to distort whatever they learn to make it fit their character. And if a murderer likes to do that, he can find sources to kill. That's my feeling.
Other questions?
Thank you. We have other questions back here. Yeah.
Yes, please.
Yes, if you just stand up and so we can hear your question, please.
I do have to understand.
I want to ask why you, for the past 60 years, the state of Israel is doing the same thing all over again with Palestine.
Yeah. Okay, question is about Palestine.
Yeah, very, very good question. But your reading is not very good. You see, you have to learn to differentiate between propaganda and reality. If you go to Israel and see what is done and call it racial hatred or whatever, then by all means I will know that you saw the truth. If you read what people want you to know, it's not good enough. Do you ever question how many Jews are allowed to live in Egypt? Do you ever question how many Jews were driven out of Egypt without a penny and had to leave without anything? Do you ever question how many people live in Saudi Arabia? Do you ever question how many Jewish people live in Jordan? Do you ever question how many Jewish people live in Syria? Do you know how many Arabs live in Israel, which is the tiniest country? After you look at those facts, I might find you smiling in a different way.
I'm sorry, it's just hundreds of thousands of people are dying every day. Gaza right now is being surrounded by military.
Really?
Before the state of Israel, Egyptians had Jews friends. Jordan had friends before 1984.
Yeah, but because Egypt decided that the Jews should not have a country, they're killing. They decided to leave.
Other questions? Over here, yes.
May I just
follow up
a little bit?
Yeah.
Do you know the history of Palestine? Do you know that 90% of the area was given to Arabs and 10% to Jews? Do you know of that? Do you know that in the beginning, before there was a Jewish country, the Zionists offered the Arabs a bi-national country and they refused? You don't know that?
I do. I'm aware of the whole situation. I'm asking
you. You are aware of the whole situation?
Most of it, at least. Just why kill?
Try to make a trip. Then I wouldn't have to talk here.
Yeah. Over here. Yes, please.
How did you get captured?
Pardon me?
How did you get captured to the concentration camp? How did that happen?
One doesn't get captured. A soldier came up to our apartment with a gun, told us to pack up and leave and go downstairs and join another group of people. We must have been about 10,000. And from there we went to the train and they locked us up in cars. And we traveled for quite a while, and then afterwards we were taken out of car along with the dead people that were there, because many people died in the cars, and then we were driven by foot and from hundreds of miles until we reached the final destination where most of the people died anyway.
Question? Yes, over here.
Another question. I was wondering if your book talks about maybe your musical life, and did that affect part of, was that influence maybe your music on what you experienced in concentration camp, or was that something that you was something?
My music life?
Yeah.
I had
no
music. How did you get into the violin, I guess, was the question.
Yeah, did you use that as an influence, or did you use that as more trying to forget maybe what happened, or?
No. I felt that music was in me, and it was the only subject that I found myself not having to learn much about, and I was very touched by music, and unfortunately I had to stop it when I was 10 and continued when I was 17, so I lost 7 years.
Maybe one more question? Any? Over here, yes.
Yeah, first of all, thank you for coming, and I think there's no more powerful evidence or of resilience than hearing somebody like you. It is extremely inspiring to hear somebody that has survived the Holocaust. I have been a few survival births, and I have most of them have kept their story inside of them, and I have never understood how they were able to deal with it on an everyday basis. And my father's cousin was one of them, and she had nightmares every night. But in spite of that, she never talked about that until the last years when she was going to die. So I'm wondering if that has helped you cope with it in a better way, coming and speaking to me.
No, as a matter of fact, I started speaking when I stopped getting nightmares. I did not want to talk before. First of all, I was too busy getting used to a normal life. It took me a long time to feel normal again. And I realized that if I had thought about my background, about my past, I would not survive. I would wind up in an institution. I had to go on with life. So I didn't want to think about it. But then later, I felt that I was able to afford to start thinking about it and remembering it. Many things were buried in the back of my mind. So at this point, I feel I can talk about it already. And I talk about it without hate and without generalizing and without hating every German I meet or any other anti-Semite that I might meet or even anyone that might hate me from any other any member of other religion or nationality. I harbor no hate.
And maybe on that note, we'll draw this to a close. I know I want you to join, I hope you'll join me in thanking Samuel Martyr from New York.